This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, a state far from Illinois has an idea that could help with the Asian carp problem. The invasive fish is a nuisance here in the Midwest. We'll find out more. The weed killer Roundup is controversial. Some claim it can cause cancer, but farmers have relied on it for so long they're not quite ready to give it up. State lawmakers have approved placing a question on next year's ballot that would change Illinois' income tax system from a flat tax to a graduated tax. Opponents say it would drive wealthier individuals and their investments out of the state. However, an analysis casts doubt on that claim.
The people who appear to be leaving are not the wealthier taxpayers, but those of modest income, those who are poor, and those who live downstate.
That and more coming up on today's Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the debate over changes to Illinois' abortion laws at the State House brought out the emotions on both sides of the issue. We'll have a story. Also, the complicated relationship between Midwest farmers and the weed killer Roundup. And getting a little bit of literature from a vending machine. That and more on today's Statewide. First today, Gulf of Maine lobstermen are casting around far and wide for new kinds of bait now that federal regulators have cut their herring quotas by 70%. Some possible solutions include the mass importation of a nuisance fish from right here in the Midwest. Fred Bever has the story.
Fisheries managers estimate a 50-million-pound herring gap in Maine over the next year, and to help close it, they are turning to colleagues in Illinois.
You see three species of carp here, right?
Here on a rainy fishing day in the Illinois River, State Invasive Species Coordinator Kevin Irons oversees the capture of dozens of fish, all freshwater carp, which were introduced to the Mississippi Basin decades ago. They've proliferated at epic scale, crowding out native fish and damaging ecosystems.
The bighead, the silvers, and the grass carp, you also see some of the common carp. I like to call them grandpa's carp. They've been around a long time, but we've got four different species of invasive fish here.
But one person's invasive species, it turns out, could be another's bait. Irons is working with counterparts in Maine to test the fish and the water they come from to make sure that should they be trucked east for lobster bait, they do not bring exotic diseases to the Gulf of Maine. The primary concern is a virus that can cause massive die-offs among freshwater and marine species, including herring, that's called VHS.
Viral hemorrhagic septicemia. We've never seen it in the Illinois River. We're right on the forefront of surveillance since 2005, so we have confidence that these are very healthy fish. They don't threaten other places. They're very good for humans to eat and other things.
For me, it's all still about safety. There may be 50 million pounds that could come here tomorrow. If it's not safe, I'm not allowing it.
That's Patrick Kelleher, Maine's Commissioner of Marine Resources. His staffers have been back and forth to Illinois as they try to determine whether the carp, once killed and frozen, would pose a biosecurity threat to the Gulf. Kelleher says before giving his stamp of approval, he wants to see that systems are in place to ensure that no fish or water come from anywhere near Lake Michigan, where VHS has been found.
It's really about chain of custody because, for instance, there could be mixing. They could be, yes, that facility could be getting them from the Illinois, but they might be getting them from somewhere else that we don't want them from.
Initial samples tested by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are so far good, and some Maine lobstermen are interested. Lauren Falkingham docks his lobster boat down east in Jonesboro. He says that back before Maine became the first Atlantic state to institute bait biosecurity rules more than a decade ago, he had good luck with carp.
It seemed to work all right.
Falkingham and other lobstermen are also considering a number of other bait sources. Menhaden from the Gulf of Mexico, known as pogies here, were just added to the state's approved bait list. Some scientists are trying to engineer manufactured lobster baits from fish meal. And Falkingham is one of a growing number of lobstermen who've been experimenting with pig hides. He says pig hide lasts longer in the water than other baits, and lobsters seem to like it.
I actually believe that we could probably bait exclusively on pig hide, and in the long run, probably even bait our traps cheaper than we ever could have on herring.
But while lobsters may enjoy a bit of bacon, will humans like pork-fed lobsters? Matt McDonald, proprietor of First Rate Bait in Alton, Maine, says he joined forces with a University of Maine researcher to do a taste test.
We force-fed lobsters traditional fish bait, and we force-fed lobsters this bait. And then we purged them for like 3 days, cooked them, and they basically did a blindfold test with 40 people, and 39 chose lobsters that were eating pigskins.
Since he started selling pig hides for bait 11 years ago, McDonald says there have been other concerns to overcome. The legislature 2 years ago required that all hair be removed from animal hide bait to avert any chance of hairballs ending up in a lobster tail. And lawmakers required that fat content be minimized. McDonald says he's also had to fend off an old maritime superstition that swine on deck bring bad luck.
Ham sandwiches, you shouldn't eat bacon in the morning before you're jumping on board.
And he says acceptance has grown over time. This winter, McDonald invested in a processing and packaging plant that will amp up capacity from last year's 2 million pounds of pig hide for bait to 10 million pounds this year. And just as the herring shortage begins to hit, McDonald says that with the retail price of herring projected to approach his pig hide price this summer, around $50 a bucket, he's feeling some pressure.
I stay up at night. I'm a little worried that 250,000 cans isn't going to be enough. But we're going to do everything in our power to knock out as much bait as we can and fill that void.
Back on the rainy Illinois River, where millions of dollars are spent every year on carp control, fisherman Sean Price says Maine could find an affordable solution to its bait problem, including some fish from Illinois that cost next to nothing.
You can honestly get these fish for free if you can supply the means to transport. Hope and pray that all this works out and Maine gets their fish. I think it would be great for everybody.
Maine Marine Resources Commissioner Patrick Kelleher says his ultimate hope is a rebound in the local herring fishery. But for now, he is waiting on the latest sample results from the Illinois waterways, and he could make a decision on the new alt bait as soon as this week. I'm Fred Bever.
Reporting help for that story also came from Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck. When the pharmaceutical company Bayer bought Monsanto last year, it inherited the weed killer Roundup. It also inherited thousands of lawsuits claiming the chemical's active ingredient, glyphosate, can be linked to a form of cancer. But farmers have used more and more glyphosate over the last 20 years to keep weeds in check, and they have a lot riding on its future. For Harvest Public Media and the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, Christopher Waljasper explains what's at stake.
To understand how important glyphosate is to farmers, you have to go back to the 1970s, before Roundup was available.
We had a chemical that would kill grass, and we had a chemical that would kill broadleaf. For the most part, we try to kill most of the weeds by cultivation, that type of thing.
That's James Benham.
I'm state president for Indiana Farmers Union.
He's farmed in southeast Indiana for close to 50 years, growing tobacco, corn, soybeans, and now hemp. When Roundup came out in 1974, Benham says
it was a cure-all. I mean, you could kill anything with it.
So farmers spent less time, manpower, and fuel worrying about weeds and were able to implement no-till farming, which reduced soil erosion. Then, in 1996, Monsanto came out with bioengineered corn and soybean seeds that were tolerant to glyphosate, meaning farmers could spray Roundup throughout the year right onto the crop.
Now we're spraying as often as 3 or 4 times a year.
As farmers used more, weeds began to adapt resistance to Roundup. Sarah Ward studies weed resistance at Colorado State University. She says resistant weeds often catch farmers by surprise.
When you get the first herbicide resistance weed in your field, your reaction is probably just to think it's a skip. But okay, no, the sprayer didn't reach that one. Maybe next year you've got a growing patch and you know, you go back and typically the response is to hit it with a slightly higher dose. And within 3 or 4 years, you know, suddenly you've got a whole field of glyphosate-resistant palm amaranth, whatever, that you can't control.
Weeds have adapted resistance to herbicides before, but by then, glyphosate had replaced most other herbicides. In 2000, Monsanto's patent expired and other companies could sell glyphosate, so more was used. Weeds grew resistant, and the answer for many was even more glyphosate.
And most farmers look at it like, well, if they tell you use a pint to the acre or a quarter, I'll be a lot better.
Which is how farmers got to using an average of 40 times more glyphosate in the Midwest. The Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting analyzed more than 25 years' worth of data from the U.S. Geological Society. They found that in some of the top corn and soybean-producing states, that increase was even greater. In 1992, Nebraska corn farmers applied less than 1 pound of Roundup per every 100 acres. By 2016, they were putting on 129 pounds per 100 acres. In Iowa, soybean farmers increased their use of glyphosate by more than 6,000% between 1992 and 2016, while the number of soybean acres only increased by 15%. To be clear, it's not like every farmer back in 92 was spraying just a few ounces of Roundup on every field. It's that fewer farmers were using smaller amounts of glyphosate. But by 2016, the chemical was the most popular herbicide out there. In an emailed statement, Bayer spokeswoman Sharla Lord said, quote, "Herbicides are an outstanding tool for dealing with weeds, but they must be part of a larger strategy. Only a combination of various weed control methods can be successful in the long term." But some weed scientists think the industry is still moving in the wrong direction.
I think we are repeating old mistakes, frankly. But some of that is maybe desperation. It's the lack of alternatives at this point.
As Bayer deals with thousands of lawsuits over health concerns, all the companies that make glyphosate claim that it's safe. And the Environmental Protection Agency agrees. But in 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently said more studies are needed to determine the health risks in humans. So while weed resistance is what farmers are worrying about, it's the public opinion that makes glyphosate's future so uncertain.
They're the driving force for this to happen. I mean, we can continue to go down this road that we are with the chemicals and the way we're doing business, or we can reevaluate and come to some consensus on the value of food.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Christopher Waljasper.
You're listening to Statewide. Experts in Illinois agree the shortage of access to mental health care for children in Illinois is severe, but there are efforts on several fronts to improve the situation. For this week's Illinois Issues In-Depth Report, Maureen McKinney looks at the problem.
Something was wrong with the little girl. That was clear by the time she was 10 years old. There were rages and sullen moods. By the time she was 13, she was missing school because her anxiety was so severe. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is marked by periods of depression and irritability interrupted by extreme highs.
We used to refer to her as Jekyll and Hyde, actually, before we had any idea of anything.
That's the girl's mother, who we'll call Jane. She didn't want her real name used to protect her daughter's privacy. When the girl was 14, her parents split up, and the family's financial situation meant that the family used Medicaid for insurance. For Jane, that meant her daughter was on a year-long waiting list.
The only way we did get her to see the doctor in the county was, we had to hospitalize her, and she was the doctor on staff at the hospital she was in. We kind of got in the back door that way. We'd be lucky if we saw her every 2 or 3 months because, you know, the caseload was just so high. And there's just no doctors. There's no psychiatrist for children that take Medicaid.
The family is hardly alone. About half the children in Illinois are in Medicaid. Heather O'Donnell is with Thresholds, a statewide mental health service provider.
About 850,000 children will experience mental health conditions across Illinois, and access to care can be extremely challenging, and oftentimes treatment is simply out of reach.
The result is growing suicide rates and increased rates of drug and alcohol abuse. Dr. John Walkup is head of child and adolescent psychiatry at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago.
Children who are anxious oftentimes fall behind in terms of their interpersonal development and their capacity to take on older adolescent and young adult roles. Young people with depression fall behind both socially as well as academically, so they have a hard time transitioning into a full, robust adolescence and young adult life. The consequences of these conditions are substantial.
Walkup said the vast majority of mental health conditions, 75% to 80%, begin prior to the age of 18. Finding care in Illinois is a serious challenge. Sarah Moscato Howe is with the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. She says that mental health services in general have suffered from a lack of funding for many years.
We can talk about the suicide crisis that's escalating. We could talk about the opioid epidemic. There's all kinds of things we are happy to talk about in a public hearing. When you get behind closed doors and you develop a budget, your priorities come out. And for the last 10 to 15 years, we have not been a priority in the state.
She says 85 of the 102 counties in the state have a chronic shortage of behavioral health workers, including psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers. A big part of that is because funding to Medicaid providers doesn't stack up as compared to the rest of the states.
Our funding rates for services are so low. The rates for psychiatry are very low. So who wants to work in Illinois where the rates are lower? Then you add a subspecialty. Now you're talking about child psychiatry. And that's pretty much a desert across the state.
There is some hope, advocates say. As a result of the lawsuit, the state has entered into a consent decree that will look at ways to expand mental health treatment to kids under 21 in the Medicaid program. The state is developing plans for a program that encourages school districts to require screening for mental health issues along with school physicals. Dr. Walkup's project to train primary care providers to do mental health screening got a $15 million gift from the Pritzker Foundation. Improvements could make a difference in the lives of people like Jane.
The system is so broken. It's just awful. And I don't know how, you know, if they'll ever be able to fix it, and hopefully they can, but something needs to change.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
Reminder to check our website for all our episodes and links to the stories you hear each week right here on Statewide. The website address is statewideshow.com. Just ahead, the issue of abortion took center stage at the Illinois Capitol this past week. We'll have a recap. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Just ahead, can we really know what the impact will be if Illinois adopts a graduated income tax? Some say it will force higher earners to leave and take their money elsewhere, but an analysis of a past tax hike found just the opposite. The details coming up. There was a long and unusually emotional debate in the Illinois House this week. Lawmakers were considering legislation aimed at keeping abortion legal in Illinois, regardless of what happens in other states or even Washington, D.C. Dana Vollmer was in the House chamber. She filed this report.
The legislation would repeal laws that, while not currently enforced, could go back into effect if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. With legislators in red states passing laws limiting or outlawing abortion, teeing up challenges to Roe, Illinois Democrats wanted to demonstrate their state is going the other way. They called their legislation the Reproductive Health Act. It would repeal laws requiring spousal consent for abortions and criminally charging doctors if they perform the procedure. The legislation also requires insurance companies to cover abortions as part of reproductive health care. Sponsoring State Representative Kelly Cassidy, a Democrat from Chicago, says it does little more than codify what's already happening in Illinois.
It is crucial that our law states that the health of pregnant patients must be paramount. The Reproductive Health Act simply incorporates this long-recognized principle so that women are supported in their ability to make the best decisions for themselves, their health, and well-being throughout pregnancy.
The law allows abortions at all stages of pregnancy, including after the fetus is viable, if it's critical to the health and life of the patient. Republican lawmakers unanimously voted against the measure. They also pursued an unusual tactic in debate, yielding most of their time to one colleague, Avery Bourne, who represents the town of Raymond and is visibly pregnant. She questioned the standards for deciding health of a mother, including but not limited to physical, emotional, psychological, and familial factors.
These definitions seem overly broad, and I am certain that most doctors, if their incentive is to perform an abortion, would be able to find some kind of loophole here to figure that out.
Born told lawmakers if they don't keep track of the reason why abortions are performed, there could be a jump in abortions after the first trimester.
For a woman at my stage in pregnancy, where the baby responds to his dad's voice as he reads him books at night, the woman could go to the facility. The baby is perfectly healthy. But if that woman says, based on my familial health, this is medically necessary, that is allowed.
Democrats like Representative Joyce Mason from Gurnee scoffed at that idea.
I am disgusted by the propaganda that is out there suggesting that any woman late in her pregnancy or even after giving birth, as I've heard from some, and then decide, I just don't want this child, and simply end its life. It's disgusting and it's insulting to women and it's insulting to the doctors who have taken that Hippocratic oath.
Other Democrats conjured up what life was like before abortions were legal. Representative Sarah Feigenholz from Chicago described one doctor's experience working in the septic unit of Cook County Hospital in 1948, when desperate women attempted to perform their own abortions with whatever tool was at hand.
Paintbrushes, pencils, knitting needles. He saw perforated vaginas, untreatable infections, and women who hemorrhaged to death.
Men on the Democratic side of the aisle echoed one another in saying, "We trust women." State Representative Maurice West is a Democrat from Rockford.
We fought a civil war because we wanted to keep black bodies chained and enslaved. And now you're asking me, a black man, to put policy chains on a woman's body.
After more than 2 hours of emotional debate, the legislation passed the House on a vote of 64 to 50. The Republicans were joined by 6 Democrats voting against the legislation. 4 other Dems voted present. Reaction from outside the Capitol was swift and in some cases severe. Liberal groups praised the outcome, but the Roman Catholic Bishop of Springfield, Thomas Papraki, called the House vote gravely immoral and the legislation evil. I'm Dana Vollmer.
And as of the time we record, statewide, the legislation still awaiting action in the Illinois Senate. If senators were to approve it, they would send it on to the governor's desk. Governor J.B. Pritzker has said he looks forward to signing it into law. Illinois lawmakers have approved a plan that could change how Illinois taxes income. In the nearly 40 years the state has had an income tax, it's been a flat tax, meaning no matter how much you earn, you pay the same percentage. Now Governor Pritzker and other advocates of a graduated tax say it's time for a new approach. They want higher earners to pay more. The plan that passed this week places a question on the fall ballot next year that could accomplish just that. While there are supporters, the idea also has critics, and they say it will be devastating for the state as those with more money leave Illinois. We can't predict the future, but we can look at what happened when the state raised the income tax by 67% earlier this decade. Bob Sector, a senior editor with the Better Government Association, he wrote about it and joined me to talk more.
We know what happened when that occurred. There were a lot of warnings that this was going to incentivize wealthier taxpayers to leave the state for greener pastures where the taxes weren't that high. The reality is, when you look at tax data from the IRS, the opposite happened. The number of wealthier taxpayers grew substantially, even as the overall pool of taxpayers in Illinois either stagnated or retreated some. And what we see in the data is that the people who appear to be leaving are not the wealthier taxpayers, but those of modest income, those who are poor, and those who live downstate.
Why would certain people who have to pay more money, and they make more money, why would they continue to do better, even more people moving into that tax bracket?
Well, first of all, you have to understand the complicated equation of why people leave or stay. And it's nowhere near as simple as some of the ideologues who are driving the debate about Illinois' population loss or stagnation are saying. That in the particular period after the tax hike, you also had a recovering economy. So we were coming back from that. The recovery was not even, though. The people who did well in the recovery, or did most well in the recovery, were those of higher incomes. there's a lot of reasons why they may leave Illinois or why they may stay, and they don't always fit those neat, ideologically driven arguments about, well, high taxes, people leave. People make decisions on an individual basis, and the people who appear to be leaving are the people, or at least the tax data shows the people who appear to be leaving, are the people who have the least opportunity.
We're talking with Bob Sector. He's a senior editor with the Better Government Association, talking about an analysis of an income tax increase a few years back in the state of Illinois and its impact on both the poor and also the wealthy. We're talking about the flat tax and the increase that took place during that time. Now we're in this discussion about a graduated income tax, the legislature having passed that on. Voters will make the final call if they want to change the Constitution of the state of Illinois. Can we say that this is an apples-to-apples comparison when it comes to who will do okay, who will stay in the state of Illinois if graduated rates are in, are put into place?
Well, no. I mean, we're looking in a crystal ball, and the only period we could look at that had historical records was the period of the past. We don't know precisely what'll happen in the future. What we do hear is a lot of the same arguments that were made when the flat tax was increased, and you know, if that is any guide, then you could say that these dire consequences likely won't happen.
So one of those arguments that's often made is you're going to be taxing the people who invest in business, who create jobs, and taxing them more is going to hurt the economy. But going back to your analysis, that's not what you found.
No, that is not what we found. And we have there's an interesting dynamic going on here, which overlays federal tax policy with Illinois tax policy. You know, those people who make the most, I mean, the very wealthy, not the sort of wealthy, but the very wealthy, have done quite well under the Trump tax cuts. So if Illinois claws back some of that revenue, are they really going to be hurting? We can't really prove that one way or the other, but it's going to take a very deep economic punishment, to get them to leave.
Now, Governor Pritzker has said that the tax rates would only impact the wealthiest and the families earning $250,000 or more. But, of course, many are leery of that claim with a graduated tax. They say the rates could be changed later and more people can be paying higher taxes as time goes on. Let's be honest, not a lot of people have a lot of faith and trust in the state of Illinois government. Do they have a reason here to be concerned about this going forward?
Well, I mean, but look at the flat tax now. You can raise rates now. Matter of fact, one of the complaints of the opponents of the graduated tax is that the flat tax has been raised. So to argue that you could, if you have a graduated tax, you could change the rates later is a somewhat specious argument.
Of course, again, we're going back to an analysis of the flat tax, and we didn't see rates go up as high on that flat tax as we are hearing that wealthier individuals will pay under a graduated tax system. So again, could we see that more people with money will leave the state of Illinois because the taxes will just get to such a high level that they can't stay here?
Anything's possible. The top rate that Pritzker is talking about now for the wealthy is somewhere a little short of 8%. That is that's clearly more than Indiana. It's might be slightly higher than Wisconsin. It's less than Minnesota, far less than California. There are other states that have no state income tax at all, but have different mixes of taxes. So one state might have one mix, another state might have another mix, but you end up paying in the end regardless of what it is.
Just a few seconds we have left here. What do you want to leave people with regarding the analysis that you've done and, of course, the conversation that is still to come over the next several months as we gear up for the 2020 fall election and the graduated tax question?
Well, I think probably the simplest message here is that there isn't anything simple about this. And Illinois is in a financial pickle right now in great measure because the politicians of both parties, going back decades, have tried to tell voters they can get something for nothing. And that's why the pensions are in bad shape. That's why the property taxes are so high, because school funding is so low from the state. You know, these things snowball and make things worse. So if this graduated tax idea seems draconian to some, it's kind of a consequence of really bad bipartisan administration of our finances going back decades. And trying to fix that is not going to be painless.
Bob Sector is senior editor with the Better Government Association and wrote about how an income tax increase in Illinois did not seem to hurt the highest earners. His analysis comes as Illinois voters will be asked next year to decide if they want to go from a flat tax to a graduated tax. You can find Bob Sector's analysis at our website, statewideshow.com. Meet the newest idea for affordable housing in Chicago, three flat apartment buildings made on assembly lines like cars. That's set to happen at a factory on the city's southwest side, and Linda Lutton with member station WBEZ reports.
The three flats will be made as modules in a giant warehouse in Little Village. Think of them as completed rooms that move down an assembly line.
You see the conduit going in for the light switches and the outlets. You see the copper already in place for the sinks. As that finishes up, then drywall starts to go in. Light fixtures will go in.
That's Tim Swanson, head of design at Skenderm, the company running this high-tech factory. Here, lasers and manufactured parts mean precision, Swanson says, is impossible in traditional home building. By the end of the line, the modules...
they're fully finished. If this were a hotel room, the bed's sitting there and the TV's on the wall.
Build time for an entire three-flat is just 6 days. Then the modules are shrink-wrapped, driven on a truck to a vacant lot, and stacked three high to form a non-traditional Chicago three-flat.
By Christmas time of this year, there'll be 30 families with homes on lots that used to be vacant.
The company's first big client is as noteworthy as the new strategy, Sterling Bay, the developer of megaproject Lincoln Yards. They're buying the first 10 three-flats to roll off this production line, and they plan to plant modular housing on 100 vacant lots on the south and west sides, in part to fulfill their obligation to the city to build affordable housing. The Skender factory will eventually employ 150 union workers.
I worked outside for the last 30 years, so coming inside here, it's like a dream job.
Ron Christmas is a lead carpenter.
In the suburbs, as a house builder, we pre-built the walls, and we started pre-building the stairs, and we started pre-building the trusses. So now we're just taking it to another level where it's all going to be completely finished indoors now.
We need to be creative and try new ideas.
Marisa Navarra is slated to become Chicago's housing commissioner. She says Mayor Lori Lightfoot has talked about
things like shipping containers and tiny homes, and I think this fits right in line with those ideas. Some things may not work, but if we only stick with the things we've been doing, then we already know what we'll get.
On the west side, we've gotten vacant lots.
We have hundreds of these lots in this neighborhood. Hundreds of them.
All 10 of the initial three flats purchased by Sterling Bay are coming here to Alderman Walter Burnett's 27th Ward. There's little private development here. It costs more to build a house than you could sell it for. Burnett welcomes the modular homes.
It will help to stabilize the community and also enhance it. The big deal is going to be for me is trying to do a lottery, because everybody's going to want to move in these houses.
I saw a prototype in the factory. It's like an IKEA showroom in there. Clean lines, modern.
There were two modules that made this. It just looks like a regular apartment.
This might be surprising, but affordable housing is actually very costly to build. There are restrictions around materials and wages. Skender says its three flats will meet all the city codes, but will cost $335,000 per unit to construct and assemble. That's not really cheaper than what current affordable housing costs. Skender says as it produces more modulars and gets better at it, costs will go down. Joy Arugete works for a group that's been building affordable housing for 50 years, Bickerdike Redevelopment Corporation. They're always looking for cheaper ways to build, she says, but she's cautious.
I don't think that there's any silver bullet, and that includes the production of modular housing.
At this point, it's an idea and it's untested.
Swanson sees modular housing as something like the modern-day bungalow.
You think about bungalows and two flats. These were housing typologies that were standardized in design, that were approved by the city, that could just be deployed. It's not that dissimilar from what we're doing today.
Production of the city's very first modular three-flat begins Tuesday. Linda Lutton, WBEZ News.
There's more of Statewide ahead. Stay with us. This is Statewide. Imagine getting a short story from a vending machine. One Illinois library has that available. More details on it coming up. Earlier this year, prison staff at the Danville Correctional Center in East Central Illinois removed about 200 books from a college in-prison program's library. And as Lee Gaines reports, a lot of the books are about race. Some were children's books.
Visiting Day by Jacqueline Woodson. Only on visiting day is there chicken frying in the kitchen at 6 a.m.
This is Rebecca Ginsburg. She directs the Education Justice Project, or EJP. That's a college and prison program at Danville Correctional Center in East Central Illinois. The program offers University of Illinois classes to incarcerated men at the prison. The children's book Ginsburg's reading is one of about 200 that were removed from the program's library inside the prison. It's about visiting an incarcerated parent.
And maybe Daddy is already up, brushing his teeth, combing his hair back, saying, "Yeah, that pretty little girl of mine is coming today."
Can I ask why you got so emotional?
I think that I got so emotional because the book is a children's book, but it was in our library, the EJP library at Danville Correctional Center. And to think about how many of our incarcerated students have read that book, thinking about their own children, and that the book is now gone, is painful to me.
Ginsburg says the prison's general library contains legal, some fiction, and nonfiction books.
But not anywhere near what would be required for a university student.
That's why Ginsburg says EJP created their own library with a collection of about 4,000 books. Ginsburg says they haven't had much trouble getting books into the prison since the program started 10 years ago. That changed last fall. Books like Uncle Tom's Cabin and Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, weren't allowed in. Then, in January, Ginsburg says prison staff went into EJP's library and removed several boxes of books. The EJP students found out first.
And when I learned that the books had been removed, I felt a pit in my stomach. I felt sick.
EJP staff were forced to take the boxes of removed books back to the U of I campus. Ginsburg says she wasn't given a reason for the removal. So I asked outgoing Illinois Department of Corrections Director John Baldwin.
Somehow, a lot of books got into the institution without going through our review process. That was our fault. We let books in, and some of them maybe shouldn't have been. Some of them are very good books.
Multiple emails between EJP and prison staff show that at least a portion of the books removed from the library were approved by prison staff to enter the facility. So how did prison staff at Danville know that these books didn't get reviewed? I asked Baldwin.
I don't know how the facility found that out. I have no idea.
Ginsburg, however, doesn't buy the review explanation, and neither does Michael Tafoya. He's a former EJP student. I met with Tafoya at the EJP offices on the U of I campus. That's where the removed books are now. We went through them together.
So I see a title, Up From Slavery, Race Matters.
Tafoya and Ginsburg say race is really the issue.
It seems like there's a theme, even though I haven't gone through the boxes. What are they afraid of?
I asked Baldwin why some books aren't allowed in the prison. He referred me to their publication review policy. The policy says material may be barred from a prison because it's obscene or encourages violence. Tafoya says these books didn't cause riots or fights, but he thinks there's a reason prison staff don't want prisoners reading them.
If people like me that come from poverty-stricken neighborhoods learn how to be much more and value ourselves, we're going to be less likely to be breaking the law. And if that happens, then less people are going to go to prison. Less people go to prison, then that means there's going to be less prisons. That means that a lot of people are going to be out of jobs in the future.
Ginsburg says the prison will allow her to submit the removed books through another review process. That's something she plans to do. Meanwhile, Ginsburg and other advocates for education in prison are launching a campaign to get more transparency around how books get into prisons. They plan to lobby lawmakers to pass legislation to ensure something like this won't happen again. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Got a minute for reading, but only a minute? Well, you can still partake in some great literature. Just inside the front door of the Glen Ellen Public Library, there's a cylindrical device that is plugged into a wall. It is the state's first and only short story dispenser. Brian O'Keefe stopped by the library and met with the director, Dawn Bussey.
What is this?
Well, the short story machine or dispenser is just that. It's a small kiosk that we can actually move different places. It just has to have electricity, and then it has its own connection to the cloud. And in the cloud, there's a database of thousands and thousands of short stories and poems. And there's a push to try to convince people to read shorter literature. It goes along with some of the studies that are out there that say that people don't read books necessarily because they don't have the time. And books are actually getting longer. It's not unusual now for books to be over 300, maybe 400 pages, even so much so that James Patterson conglomerate is pushing to produce some 100 or 150-page novels in order to kind of keep their market interested. So this kind of goes along with that idea. Now, so often if we have a few minutes, what we will do is we will pull out our phone or our device and we'll start scrolling through and keeping ourselves busy that way. Wouldn't it be better if you could have a 1 minute, 3 minute, or 5 minute story or poem that was really an awesome piece of literature? That's the idea behind this dispenser. That's what it does. It dispenses 1 minute, 3 minute, and 5 minute either stories or poems. And we set ours up a little differently than some of the others that are available. Normally you just select 1 minute, 3 minute, or 5 minute. We didn't think maybe that was exactly right for Glen Ellen. So what we did instead was children's stories, general public, meaning adult, and Spanish. I'm happy to tell you that the unit, we installed it here in our lobby on March 28th. About 50% of them are children's stories, about 8% are Spanish, and then the remaining are the general or adult stories. And I can tell you, and sadly somebody took my sample story I'd been keeping with me, but the quality of the literature is very high. And this one story that I had, it's just a 3 minute story, but I couldn't tell you the end. I mean, the end was completely a surprise to me. And so I've been sharing it with everyone that I see, and now someone took it away.
That brings me to one of the things I want to ask you about. Are these short stories by known authors? Are they unknown authors? Are they new authors? What is the story content?
It's a great question. Right now we have it set up for what they call classics, and so you will get things like Milton's works from the 1500s or classic children's tales. But the database, as I mentioned, has thousands of different stories in it, and many of them are brand new from authors that you don't know, because Short Edition, which is the company that produces the device, they actually run short story writing contests as well. Matter of fact, they ran one last fall, and their number one prize winner lives in none other than Wheaton. And so we invited Mim over the other day, and it was her first chance to get to actually see a dispenser, because the dispenser's out of France, and we are the first library in Illinois to have one. So it gave her a chance to see the device, and I've actually had it set up right now so that 10% of the time, if you press the general public or adult button, her story will actually be produced for you. And it's a lovely story. If you are interested, you can see if you can get it when you push the button, or you can actually go to the Short Edition website as well. And because she was one of their prize winners, you can find it and read the link. It's also a dynamite short story that just has depth and so much meaning. But yes, she's an unknown author, although she has two novels that she's trying to have published. But suddenly her short story has caught attention. And not only did I ask if we could have it in our dispenser, but now Short Edition has approached her, and they're translating it into other languages and putting it into their dispensers throughout the world.
So this is a French initiative.
Correct.
How did it end up in Glen Ellen for the first place in Illinois?
Great question. Actually, I had seen it in the news last August when I was on vacation and started researching it. And then I was at a conference in San Diego at the beginning of December and was lucky enough that they were one of the vendors there. So I actually got to see a kiosk then. And so I brought it back and told the foundation about it and actually set up a teleconference so that they could see it, you know, and ask some questions and pitch the idea of, you know, purchasing one for us. And the foundation thought it was a great idea and they paid for it and we had it shipped over from France.
So you've placed it right here inside the door.
Correct.
What's been the response? I mean, I know you've got almost 1,100 stories dispensed. But what are people saying about it other than pushing the button?
People are enjoying it. One of the concerns the foundation had had is, well, you know, are they just going to want to dispose of the story? But like I mentioned to you, just like I held on to my story and it was so good, now someone has walked away with it, that they're doing the same thing. They're walking away with them. They're taking them. They want to share them with people because it's really great literature.
What's your hope for this? I mean, is this it's a kind of a novelty? The novelty is what brought me out to talk to you about it. But beyond the novelty, what's your hope?
If we can use this sort of innovative technology to get people to read, that's my number one hope. Number two is because of its mobile nature, we can take it out. We're going to take it out to places like the YMCA, maybe some of our other restaurants or schools. And again, try to capture people when they've got that 1 minute or, you know, 2 minutes that they would read something if it was right there and great, you know, a great way to spend their time. So that's the idea behind it. Have it here for a little while and then move it around town.
Have you heard from any of your neighboring libraries about this technology that you're the first to have in Illinois?
I haven't heard from the librarians. I did hear from a teacher in Elmhurst, and I actually heard from a friend's president out in New York.
What's the library community saying about this?
Well, other libraries, especially on the West Coast and the East Coast, have them already. Some publics, more of the academics, and even some of the I think it was actually Harvard Medical School that I was reading about. But so some of them have done them. There's a library out on the East Coast that actually purchased one and then put it at the DMV, which, I mean, what a great place to try to give somebody 3 or 5 minutes worth of great reading while you're standing in one of those queues. And so other places have put them in malls or shopping centers, malls, hospitals, you know, places like that. We don't have, you know, any of those in Glen Ellen, and so we're going to move it around to the places that we do have.
I know your logo is right at the top of it, but how important is it for you to reinforce the idea that this short story machine is a library thing?
I think it's very important to reinforce that, because my hope is if you enjoy those little snippets of reading, then maybe that would intrigue you to either go to our website and download some of the digital things that we have there, or better yet, come to the library and discover some of the wonderful resources we have here in our building.
Let's play the library, the short story machine.
Please do.
I'm going to press general public. So what does it do?
Just give it a sec. And then it'll spit out. Okay, and now you just pull that out.
Oh, it's very short.
That one is short. That would be a 1 minute. It looks like a poem, perhaps.
Hmm.
Tells you up on the top what the genre is. So, yes, this is classic literature. You can see that it was written by an author who lived from 1864 to 1941. And it's called Waltzing Matilda. Oh, there once was a swagman camped in the billabong under the shade of a colaba tree, and he sang as he looked at his old Billy Boiling, "Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda, my darling? Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag, who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?" I want to break out in song. That's the way I know Waltzing Matilda. But you'll notice then on the bottom, too, it gives us a great place where we can put our logo again and send out messages to individuals. And what we're finding is people find it sort of a treat as they take it out of there. Sometimes they read it right now. Sometimes they tuck it in their pocket and take it away with them. One of the things that I've found that works really well, because in this renovation we created this little seating area, and the idea behind it is it's a place to wait if someone's meeting you here or maybe you're waiting for a ride. The staff have been telling me that that's indeed what is happening. They saw a caregiver the other day waiting with some children. They were waiting for their ride. So one of the kids came over, printed a story, and the caregiver proceeded to read the story to them while they waited for their ride.
Hmm. How long do you expect to have it? Do you have this forever now?
The foundation purchased the kiosk. Now the library pays a subscription to have access to those stories that are in the cloud. So yes, I would anticipate it being here for as long as it's of interest to our public.
Dawn Bussey is director of the Glen Ellyn Public Library. She spoke with Brian O'Keefe about the first short story dispenser in Illinois. If you'd like to see what it looks like, we have a link at our website, statewideshow.com. And that's it for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being with us this week. Be sure to join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And again, check the website, statewideshow.com. Find this episode, all past episodes there as well. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.